There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now something completely different.
The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
So this week we're browsing the titles appearing at the 2018 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature for some answers to the question we all seem to have at the beginning of every new year. How can I be happier? Well, quite frankly, by listening to Gillian read Scott's editions of various
books. Get people to read Scott's books to us.
But in a sea of self-help books and get happy quick guides, is there a book out there for the realists searching for inner peace? The first one, by the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen, is what we'll be talking about today. Chris, do you want to bring us in with the title of the book?
Yeah, I certainly can. So this is the Little Book of Lykke, which is Danish for happiness. And the subtitle to this is the Danish Search for the World's Happiest People. So it's by an author, as you said, Mika Viking. And this is off the back of a book that he's written, which was called The Little Book of Hygge, which is all about this concept of coziness and happiness. And essentially, Hygge took Europe by storm a couple of years ago. And as you said, he's the CEO of the Danish Happiness Institute. And what's great about this book is it's researched, right? I mean, it's not just my view on happiness in different parts of the world, but it's really well researched in terms of what makes people happy. And statistically, the Danes are the happiest people in the world. But why is that? And I think he goes on this search to understand, well, why are people happy in different countries around the world?
One thing that I did wonder as I was, you know, reading the Little Book of Lykke and doing some research on the Little Book of Hygge as well is, you know, what exactly qualifies Mike Viking to do what he does? How does somebody become the, you know, CEO of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen? Because before we get into that, I kind of want to know why he does what he does. So here's a little bit of information about Mike Viking.
Mike Viking is the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute. It's a Copenhagen-based think tank dedicated to exploring how to measure happiness, understanding why some people are happier than others, and strives to improve quality of life for people across the world. In addition, Mike is research associate for Denmark at the World Database of Happiness. He's also the author of the New York Times best-selling The Little Book of Hygge and The Little Book of Lykke. His books have sold more than 1 million copies and have been translated to more than 30 languages.
A question that Mike often gets, and that I'm going to pose to you, is surely happiness is subjective. How can you study it in the first place?
Well, that's a great question. And I think he breaks happiness down into some core key components. And rather than focus on anything and everything that could determine happiness, he focuses on the most important things that he determines drive happiness in people's lives. And then he tries and measures them, right? He tries to measure them in a really systematic way. And you could take GDP, right? So money, okay?
That's the traditional way, isn't it? And that's why I like his approach, which is that how can you assess whether a country's happy because it's got a higher GDP than another country is?
Yeah, exactly. So the classic way, take GDP, divide it by the number of people per capita, and then you get to, you know, well, how much money do people make? And really, he's at the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Yes, you need money. But really, what are those measures? And the book is broken down into some of these chapters, which I'm just furiously trying to get to the list here, which will determine.
Yes,
thank you.
So the first thing he highlights is togetherness and community. Another thing he highlights is money. But his point is that while you have to have a basic level of money for happiness, you get to a point where it doesn't achieve anything anymore for you. Health, freedom, and trust/kindness. They're his five areas that he focuses on.
See, the togetherness and community, the community bit, when I was reading through that, I think some people, particularly with the Hygge book, were maybe a little bit cynical about some of the things that he brings up. And he brings up things like making sure that you introduce yourself to your neighbours, you know, and have, you know, little community events that you put on. But actually, when I stopped to think about it, when we know that loneliness is becoming such a big issue, you know, there's so much research going into how this is actually becoming a massive problem for people's mental health, things like this actually do matter.
And they do. Yeah, I agree. I think there are different ways to do it, because I do think a lot of people are cynical. And I make it a point not to meet any of my neighbours that are within walking distance in case they start popping in. But I think you can have a community in another way, like an online community. So, for example, if you live here in Dubai, there are so many groups for your particular type of person. So a British mum's group or you know, various sports interest groups. And that works in the same way, in that people have people to call on. And this idea that everybody shares what they're good at. So perhaps someone says, I'm happy to babysit for you. I'm great with pets. I have a great big toolbox and I can help fix things. And that's quite nice, that everybody can kind of share knowledge that way. And I like that a bit more than this idea about everybody popping around with like casseroles to welcome you to the neighborhood and things like that. It's a bit ooh.
I think you're 100% right, because it is genuinely helpful information when he goes beyond the title, yes, togetherness and visiting your neighbors, because my initial reaction was many British neighbors, people's, yeah, reaction was not say hello to the neighbors. No way, it's not happening ever.
Well, look, what's so nice about this is I think you do need that what community works for you, so that online community. But there's some great examples through this book of how people have set up communities that work for them.
Yes.
Right. So in a street in Australia, they wanted to get a more of a community feel, and so they understood what resources people had. And so there's a group of three ladies that wanted to learn how to sing, and four doors down there was a former choir teacher. So hey, that connection was made, and that sense of togetherness and community, I think he would actually push and challenge you a little bit about that online space, that the more we go into that online space, the more risk
dangerous it is. No, I do
that we
see
don't,
that.
That we don't get that I own sense of community.
I'm at the wrong end of a spectrum of sociability and I do appreciate that most people would move further towards the friendly end.
We've had a text message come in from Jonathan who says, Hygge is a recent fad, but the Germans have known about it, and there's a word in German, which I'm not pronouncing, since the dawn of time. This reminds me of something I wanted to bring up. And yes, a lot of these concepts may feel familiar to some people. Some of it is nothing new. It's something that maybe we've known about for a while. But some of the research that's been done is new. And one in particular that I want to talk about, because you were talking about GDP and the whole equating happiness with money thing. There's one bit of the book where he's at a conference, I think actually in Dubai, mm-hmm, and he's talking to somebody there for a conference on happiness. And they did a study that said that correlated the amount of money that you earn depends on happiness rather than the other way around.
Yeah, there's some interesting statistics in here. So would you rather earn more money on average than your neighbours
and be
relatively wealthy, or be more rich than you are now but earn less than the average population around you? And the psychology of people is, actually, I'd probably rather earn a little bit more money than everybody else, where ironically, if everybody's happy, right, and we're all earning an equitable amount, then you shouldn't be looking at, don't look at how you are relative to others.
Yeah, but then do you remember the bit with the monkey? That was really interesting. So it was showing that it was a real innate thing. So there was a monkey who was happy doing tasks for cucumbers, but as soon as another monkey got a grape, he threw all of his toys out the pram and wouldn't do the tasks anymore.
The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
So what you should be reading, this week we're browsing the titles appearing at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature for answers to that question we all seem to have at the beginning of every new year: how can I be happier? Now, before we went away very briefly, we were talking about The Little Book of Luca by Mike Viking, who is the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen. And we haven't really finished chatting about this. There's a couple of things that we want to talk about. Now, we were talking off air about the fact that one of the questions I saw in an interview was about the fact that, okay, the Denmark is the happiest country in the world, isn't it? Constantly, yeah, gets that trophy, as it were. But he says, well, but what have you done?
Lego.
And he, I think his question was basically about ambition and happiness, and how, whether if you're too happy, you're not necessarily as ambitious, and whether you have to be a little bit sad to kind of improve the world or make changes or progress in a way.
And this I was thinking relates to another just very small section in the book where he's talking about parenting styles, and he talks about elephant mums, he says mums in this case but it could be dads, elephant mums and tiger mums. So he says he himself had an elephant mum who was very encouraging of what he loved himself, so whatever he showed interest in, she would encourage him to follow that path. But he knew another girl whose mum was a tiger mum, as you would say, who pushed her to do things, perhaps if she didn't even really choose to do it. She was a violin player. And he said when he heard this girl play, it was beyond anything he could ever imagine for a girl that age. And it probably took being pushed in that way in order to make her do that. Maybe the girl wasn't very happy about it,
yeah,
at that
stage.
Yeah, I
think that's the key thing. I think that's success, but is it happiness? And I was, as you were telling that story, I was thinking when I was at university, there were quite a few 12-year-olds at university with me who'd obviously been pushed all their lives. And I think it was very clear that they weren't quite as happy as everybody else. And so it is an interesting question. And there was a bit in the book that really that I found fascinating, and it talked about Harvard Business School taking a book review and tweaking it and making one version a positive version, complimenting the book and the author, and one version a negative version. And then they asked the people in the study about how intelligent they thought the critic who'd written this review was. And 14% they were 14% more likely to judge that critic as being intelligent if they wrote something negative. So it's fascinating how the world works. And we think perhaps that cynicism and negativity are signs of intelligence. And is that the right way for the world to be?
Yeah, maybe signs of questioning things more. People think you have to be giving a negative opinion in order for that to be valid.
Yeah, I think so. One, just to step back a second, one point that's important for everybody listening in, I guess what we're saying is not everybody in Denmark, right? So 77% of Danes, they get the highest ranking. It doesn't mean that everybody in Denmark all the time is walking around grinning, happier. Whereas those at the bottom of the spectrum are, you know, completely unhappy. I think what the point that he's making is that it's about relative happiness and those measures of money, health, freedom, trust, etc. And everybody can have a bad day. Right, we can all have a bad day here, we can have a bad day in Dubai, in the UK, or in Denmark, but you can be generally more content and more happy through the course of your life as a result of how these things affect your life. So that's kind of really important, I think.
My favourite part in both the Hygge book and the Luca book are when he talks about the importance of slowing down. So he even talks about having, you know, tech-free time. We need to, you know, move away from being reactive to our phones all the time, both parents and children. But about appreciating things, drawing things out, he talks about making something as a recipe in the Hygge book, and how long it took for him to get to this very simple final recipe. I can't remember what they made, and it was even terrible in the end, but it didn't matter because it was the process of enjoying that with friends and family together.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking about The Little Book of Luca by Mike Viking, who is attending the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature this year, which is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March at the Intercontinental Hotel in Dubai Festival City. And we're chatting to Chris Bradley, who's going to be moderating him at the festival this year.
Yeah, sure am. So I'm looking forward to having that session. And I think I've seen him present before, and it's pretty compelling. He does, you know, he does a great job of bringing the audience in, but also, you know, having statistics that kind of make you stop and think. And also just live examples. So, Rachel, I guess one thing I'd quote to you here, and he said in the book, is to maybe encourage you to go meet those neighbours of yours. He said, look, interestingly, noise from neighbours ceases to be annoying once you get to know their names and their stories. And I think that's kind of important. You know, how often do you get distracted or frustrated by what you hear around you? But actually, maybe when you know that it's Adam or, you know, Mohammed next door, right, bouncing the ball, and you know that he's doing it because he's trying to get into a competition, you're a bit more understanding,
yes,
of people around you.
Is Rachel convinced?
Well, that's fine as long as Mohammed and Adam don't pop round with a casserole.
You've got something in casseroles here, Rachel.
It's neighbours, isn't it? That's what they all used to bring round on neighbours when somebody moved into the street.
So one other point, I mean, we're in an environment here in the UAE, right, where VAT is just being introduced, okay? And the other parallel in the book is around the degree of taxes that the Scandinavian countries have, and Denmark has a lot of taxes. The interesting study in this book, and you can pick this book up. Anybody who doesn't like a book that is a big doorstep book, this is a small book you can pick up, take stories, put it down and come back to it, which I think is great. And he says that the Danes aren't paying taxes, they're buying a quality of life, which I think is really nice way of putting it. And Seoul in South Korea has developed relatively fast in these last few decades. And up until a point in time, they're really looking at the US model and this American view of happiness. But what they've started to do is think, actually, is the American dream really going to give us happiness? And there's government ministers from Seoul that are spending time with this author, saying, hey, how could we start thinking about emulating the Danish model as opposed to the American model to get our nation to where we want it to be? And it's fascinating.
There's a brilliant quote from South Korea, which was that if one cousin can afford to buy land, the other cousin gets a stomachache. I think that's brilliant, this idea that you judge yourself against everybody else.
There's one thing I want to read out before we move on from this to the next book in our kind of happiness saga, and that is about reading, which was part of one of the three inexpensive attitudes that can bring happiness that Mike Viking was talking about in his book. So here's a little quote about reading and how it can help you. Bibliotherapy, the art of using books to aid people in solving the issues they are facing, has been around for decades, and the belief in the healing power of books is said to go back as far as ancient Egypt and Greece, where signs above libraries would let readers know that they were entering a healing place for the soul. More recently, psychologists at the New School for Social Research found that fiction books improve our ability to register and read others' emotions. And according to an article in the Journal of Applied Social Psychology, research also shows that literary fiction enhances our ability to reflect on our problems through reading about characters who are facing similar issues and problems. Basically, reading is free therapy. So there you go. Reading being free therapy is a lovely note to leave that book on. That was The Little Book of Luca by Mike Viking. Remember, you can text into 4001 if you want to join in the conversation at any point. We don't have that much time to chat about the next book, but we will carry on when we come back. But just to give you a heads up, we're going to be talking about an engineer who has come up with a formula for happiness in Soul for Happy by Mo Gaudat. Now, Gillian, you've read this, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
So initial thoughts about this. Is this the kind of book that, say, a cynic like myself who wants kind of a realistic map to happiness would pick up?
Most definitely, yeah. So different to the Mike Viking book, this is more an internal facing book. It's looking about how to brain train yourself. That's how I would put it. About breaking habits, looking at how our thoughts are separate to ourselves and not letting them rule us in order to find a sort of straighter route to happiness.
So Mo Gaudat is the author of this book. Have a little listen to his kind of background.
Mo Gaudat is a serial entrepreneur and chief business officer at Google X, whose personal story has taught him more about life and what really matters than all the board meetings and business deals he's attended. He devised an equation for enduring happiness, which was put to the ultimate test when his son Ali died during a routine operation. His book, Solve for Happy, dedicated to Ali, explains the algorithm and collects his lessons on how to achieve uninterrupted happiness.
A little bit of information there about Mo Gaudat, who is the author of Soul for Happy, which is the book we're talking about just now. So Gillian, how does he lay out this book? Is it kind of a step-by-step approach to happiness? What's the equation?
He reveals the equation quite early in the book, but it is a step-by-step process. It's almost supposed to be like a manual, and he brings a lot of humour into it, which I really like, and he picks out specific points so that if you're flicking back to look and see, you know, can I remember these different sections, you've got that there in handy. But a bit about his story, because that's what I find particularly fascinating, how he came to write this book in the first place. So he was the chief business officer for Google X, which is the top secret arm of Google, where they come up with all their exciting new innovative engineering projects. But years earlier, he discovered in kind of a typical way, he was a bit of a workaholic, that all of the usual things and all of the usual places where you might expect to find happiness with money and status just weren't working for him at all. And he felt deeply unhappy. So as an engineer, he decided, I'm going to work through this in a methodical manner, as I would do with all of my work, and I'm going to come up with a proper equation for this. And then, sadly, years later, this was put to the test when his 21-year-old son died in a routine operation, and he and his family, obviously devastated, decided we're going to apply this and see if it actually works in practice. And it really did for them. And so now he's trying to spread this. He's got this goal to reach a million people with his equation.
So there you go. Have you read this before?
I have read it, and I thought it was really fascinating. I love the way he begins, because he probably, because he's, you know, into tech and into all that kind of stuff, but he talks about how humans have a default state, like your phone would have, and how if you press the reset button, and the default state for humans is basically happiness. And he says if you see kids, even if you watch a documentary of kids in a war-torn area, everything's awful for them, you still see children running around in the background smiling. And he's saying that's what we forget as we kind of get older and get on this treadmill where we're trying to constantly reach new goals that we've set ourselves. The world hasn't set them for us. And so his thing is, how do we get back to that state and what can we do? And I think it's a brilliant way of thinking. I really do.
He references children quite a lot, and I really like that, because it's something for us to relate back to, because we have built layers and coping mechanisms and things over the years, habitual patterns. And that's what he's trying to show us, that you can actually take control of that and break the bad habits.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
We were talking about Mo Gaudat and Solve for Happy, and there's a little bit that you want to tell us about in the book, isn't there, Gillian, about pain versus suffering, which is one of the chapters in the book?
Yeah, and it's one of these examples where he's talking about trying to get in control of our thoughts. So he says we need to distinguish the difference between pain and suffering, because pain can be a positive thing if we think about it in reaction to physical pain. We know then not to go back and touch that hot pot. You know, it's a way of teaching us something. And pain in an emotional sense can be a really positive thing. But what, when suffering comes in, is when we are replaying that pain in a constant loop for ourselves. And something like that can go on for years and years if we don't learn how to, you know, create that break in our thought patterns. So he gives you tips and techniques. It's very practical, actually, of how you can start to do that. And it takes a lot of training.
Do you have an example of any tips
and tricks?
I like
the idea about the little voice in your head. That was quite interesting. He says you have to, because everyone has this voice in their head that's always telling them things. And so he says you have to recognise that the voice isn't you, doesn't he?
Yes.
And that was quite interesting.
I love this. He talked about a girl who he'd been working with who called the voice Becky, because this had been an annoying girl that she'd known from school. So it was a way of disassociating and saying, you know, this is a separate thing from me, this is another person. So that self-critical voice that everybody has, if you can start to see it as something separate to you, it can help you, you know, it can help you to deny some of the things that it might be trying to tell
and
you.
And I thought that'd be such a fascinating way to kind of get to know people. It's almost like the equivalent of a demon, getting to know what their voice is in their head, because mine's quite funny and quite cynical. So I just wonder what's in everyone else's.
Have you got
head.
A name for your voice?
I don't.
You need one now.
I think it's evil me, to be honest.
I think if I had a voice in my head saying annoying things, which I often do, I think I like to call it Gareth.
Gareth.
I don't know why, but there you go. What about you, Chris?
I just don't want to comment on this one. This gets into very dangerous territory if I start opening up what's inside my brain. But I did have a question for you, because I've not read the book on this pain versus suffering element. Mm-hmm. So was he talking about the fact that pain, you know, is physical, and then the suffering is the replaying of emotional aspects over time? Is it all about how you'd correct yourself and try and get through this mentally?
Yeah, I think he's talking about specifically emotional pain too, and how that is something that can build us up and make us stronger and make us more able to deal with recurring circumstances like that. He even says, you know, often with children, we'll try to protect them a little bit too much from these sorts of things, but actually it's helping to build their character. The issue comes when we replay it. It's this loop of replaying a pain that no longer exists.
Yes, he talks about suffering being self-generated pain. So it's almost like you're making yourself feel pain. Only you, and you can stop it. And there's no, mm-hmm. there's a logic in being afraid of being burnt, but none in being...
Yeah, even when it no longer exists. Yes. So that emotional trauma may be past. You know, the incident that caused it will be in history by that point, but we can still keep bringing it back and re-feeling that torture.
So it's interesting. So the title of the book is Solve for Happy. So is this, I mean, is it for people that aren't happy, that want to find a structured way to get happy in their life? Or who do you see as an audience of this?
I think
this
anybody.
Book?
And I think it all comes back to this default setting. So it's all about how do you debug your system in a way. That's kind of the solve for happy is like a tech term, isn't it? You know, solve for X, solve for Y.
Yep.
And so I think he's saying you can sort of imagine yourself as a computer or as a machine that you can reset, that you can debug yourself, you know. And I know it's a little bit kind of, I don't know, maybe forced in some ways, but actually it works in many, many other ways, and it's kind of programming yourself.
And what I like about this is I've read a few books on this sort of topic, and I've been to meditation classes and things because I'm just interested in this kind of psychology, but he's a new voice in this, I think, new voice in this world of understanding happiness. To have somebody who's an engineer, I've actually seen him talking, and he is such a powerful speaker, and it's very moving because he's bringing up all of his own personal tragedies too. But hearing somebody present you this in such a practical step-by-step way is actually really quite different.
Yes, and the credentials are huge, because this is coming from someone who jumped on that treadmill and did really well. He got all the goals. He earned a fortune. Google X is most people's dream job in a way. And then he obviously went through tragedy. So he's experienced everything. And so when he talks, you think, okay, you're not making this up. This is something that's genuinely useful to you. And you can pass on.
He has some lessons, life lessons, at the end of the book to try summarise things up. And I really liked his lesson number 3, and I'll leave you all with this one. He says, life is a rental. And it's trying to get us to think of the fact that, you know, we don't own our lives, and we should appreciate all the moments that we have while we're here, appreciate the little things, and realise nothing is permanent. And I think that's just a nice reminder for everybody.
Yes. Life is a rental.
Mm-hmm.
That is brilliant. If you'd like to win a copy of Soul for Happy by Mo Gawdat, just answer the following question. We've given it away already, so it's really easy. Mo Gawdat is Chief Business Officer at A, Google X, B, TEDx, or C, SpaceX. Text in the answer with your name to 4001 with a jump.
Sorry about that.
That's okay, guys. Moving on now, because this week we're browsing the titles appearing at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature related to us searching for that answer to the question we have every single year, how can I be happier? Now, our next author is a little bit different. He doesn't exactly fall into the happiness criteria, I think. It is more of a spiritual book. Chris, would you like to introduce us to the next book we're going to be chatting about?
Yes, I'm looking at the cover of the book, and it's an amazing cover. The title is The Gift of Anger, which we were just discussing briefly. It could be perceived as absolutely nothing to do with happy. And it's by Arun Gandhi, who is, as you said before, he's one of the grandchildren of Mohammed Mahatma Gandhi, who's, I think needs no introduction.
Mm-hmm.
But if he does need an introduction, it's somebody who fought passively and was able to, from a political perspective and from a lobbying perspective, passively resist and essentially ultimately secure independence from India in 1947. And your previous speaker, Riz Khan, I mean, it's interesting listening to him as I was driving here. So these are lessons that Mahatma Gandhi essentially gave to his fifth grandchild when he stayed and followed him around for 2 years of age 12 to 14. And so Arun Gandhi, who's coming to, again, be at the Literature Festival, speaks about how he first met his grandfather at the age of 12 with a perception on who this great man was. And then over 2 years, he went from being a child to a young man and fundamentally changed how he would approach his life, how he would deal with conflict, how he would deal with challenges thrown at him, and turn that negativity, that anger that's being projected around the world or at him or at his grandfather, into things and drive positive change. So that's my kind of summary to open up.
Yeah, the thing that I noticed when I was reading it is, which is wonderful because he is the fifth grandson of Gandhi, that he says when he first met Gandhi, he wasn't Gandhi to him because he was quite young. I think he was about, was it 13 when he first met him, or 5?
No,
he went back and he met him again when he was about 12 or 13. And he was always Bapuji to him. He wasn't necessarily this big figure. And he spent, was it about 2 years with him till he was about 14 years old, where you say that he transformed from a young boy into, you know, with the wisdom of Gandhi, he became a young man.
Yeah, look, I think this is going to be a fascinating session. Arun Gandhi, he's also set up an institute in the US. He's passionate about conflict resolution, about finding peace, about bringing people together. And there's a load of stories that populate this book of the struggles that he himself as a young man in living in apartheid South Africa had to go through, stories that he's learnt and witnessed from his grandfather fighting battles in India. And, you know, one of them, which I love, when he had a first-class ticket and was arriving into the train and seated in the place where he wasn't allowed to be, right? He should have been in the third-class carriage because of the color of his skin or his, you know, his history. He was turfed off the train essentially and spent a long night overnight in the cold thinking about, and I quote, what the humiliation of fellow man. Why is it that we at times want to humiliate our fellow man? And so, you know, one of the learning from that is if you firmly believe in something, you should speak up for what you believe in a positive way to influence change. So
I was going to say, I loved the way that the title says, the gift of anger, and it's talking about how you can turn really negative feelings into a positive. So it's talking about how he'd come from this experience where he had racism from whites because he wasn't white enough, and from black people in South Africa because he wasn't black enough. And it was the lessons from his grandfather. And it reminded me a bit, we looked at Omar Saif Gobash's Letters to a Young Muslim,
yeah.
And it was the same sort of message, that rather than having to cope with racism or any kind of prejudice, you use it and it makes you a better person, it makes you stronger. And I liked that sort of messaging. I thought that was interesting.
I also really liked the structure of the book, actually. So as he's going through and sharing these tales, he always relates them back to a story of that time that he spent with his grandfather. So little things that he did that he thought he would get in trouble for his,
yes,
grandfather for. Like when he got angry at a boy when they were playing football and he thought, he wanted to throw a stone at him, and he thought, oh no, this is so terrible. But when he then goes and speaks to his grandfather, he then gets the lesson which he then shares with us. And throughout the book, they highlight the little messages from Gandhi, you know, the little lessons from Gandhi throughout.
And the humanity of Gandhi. There's that bit, was it the eggs he wasn't allowed to eat?
Yes.
So, yeah, so he lied about how... So he was being offered eggs and Gandhi said, well, have you had them before? Because obviously as grandpa he didn't want to break the parents. And he said, yes, yes, I've had them before. And he'd lied and in the end he had to go and confess. But when Gandhi said, explain what happened, he said, well, I've sort of had them before because I think they're in cake or in something else that he's eaten. And the fact that Gandhi saw that as funny and, you know, and I like that. It painted a real picture of a proper person.
It
not
does.
Just this saintly figure that you kind of know from history.
Yeah, it's lovely to see it from a family member's perspective, yes. All of the warmth and the time that he took to spend with his grandson and teach him when he was clearly so busy, but he always made sure that he was treated as equally as heads of states that he was dealing with. I just thought it was so lovely.
It was also a fascinating exploration of fame, wasn't it? Like, as in Gandhi, you don't really think of him as being a massive celebrity, but he was mobbed everywhere he went. It was like the Beatles. And, and that was a side that you don't even necessarily consider when it comes to him.
One last thing I want us to chat about before we finish up with this book is the title itself, The Gift of Anger. Now, there was a lot of chat about what they were actually going to call this book, because anger is not something that you would associate with the Gandhi name at all, is it?
No, it's not. But I think that's what's nice about it. And he deals with that in one of the early chapters, actually, where it's one of these examples where he goes and he expects to get a row because he's had this big outburst of anger. And Gandhi sits with him and they're spinning, they're cotton on their wheels as they talk through this. And he says to him, actually, I'm so pleased that you feel anger. This is a positive thing. What you need to be able to do is learn how to channel it. Anger gives you an energy and it shows that you're responding to injustice, but it's just about having the empathy to understand how you then apply that energy.
Yeah, there's some lovely metaphors around this, and there's a couple of great quotes which could be cliche, but I think actually they're very, very valid. So that metaphor around electricity, and so electricity is very powerful, it's also very dangerous, and it can be channeled for both good or, if used the wrong way, you know, could electrify you and kill you. And so The quote that I wanted to just read out was familiar on the book, and it was around that conflict resolution. And Arun Gandhi's quoting his grandfather, saying, "When we react rashly and lash out, it's as if we have shot bullets that can't be put back in the gun." And I think it's for me, you can think, "Hey, that's the kind of thing you'd see on a calendar, right?" you know, maybe that one of those cliche statements. But the more you think about it in how you live your life and how you deal with difficult situations, it really makes sense, right? It really makes sense. So there's anger in us all the time. We were talking previously, are we all happy? Relatively yes, or sometimes not. How do we manage ourselves? And I think this is really a book about how he observed how Gandhi had to manage himself, and he taught those lessons to his grandson.
I think that's a beautiful way to leave it. Just very briefly, before you head off, Gillian, would you mind telling us very quickly about the event this Wednesday that you'll be participating in, the Ladies' Lunch?
Yes, highly exciting Ladies' Lunch at the World Trade Club. I can't remember what time it is on Wednesday. Do we have?
You're in it, so that's worrying.
But it's at lunchtime. I know that. Yes, it will be myself as in my capacity as head of programming of the festival, and also Eva, who is our head of ops and events, and Yara, who is our head of marketing. We're all coming together to give you insights into the behind the scenes of the Lit Fests. So lots of secrets will be coming out at the lunch.
So if you want to go along to that, you can get in touch with the World Trade Club. And so Gillian will be there, so you can annoy her about the fact that all your favourite sessions are clashing. And maybe don't do that. Maybe don't do that. Be nice.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.